Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Be aware, our next live storytelling session, Pop-Up Stories, takes place Thursday evening, Valley Court Park, East Lansing. The theme is The Call of the Wild. So it's first-person true stories, 5 minutes or less, about the outdoors, nature, wildlife, the various encounters and things and sensations that nature is apt to produce here in the out-of-doors. That is Thursday evening, 7 o'clock at Valley Court Park in East Lansing. More information at our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. I do believe, do we have room for... We're full. Okay, I'm sorry to say we're full. Up until just a couple of days ago, we still had room for another storyteller or two, but we got a full slate. But come by and hear the stories, okay? You don't have to get all nervous and worry about telling your story. You can just listen to other people be nervous and tell their stories. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Officials are meeting with difficulty as they try to improve security and conditions at a federally subsidized housing complex in Lansing. South Washington Park Apartments is a multi-story HUD-funded apartment building for low-income people at 3200 South Washington. Problems there appear to have grown in recent months. They include unsanitary conditions, bed bugs, and a shooting death. Last Tuesday, some stakeholders organized a meeting to discuss South Washington's problems. It turned chaotic. Various officials, including our first two guests, attended that meeting. Both have key roles with federal low-income housing around Lansing. Patricia Baines Lake is the executive director of the Lansing Housing Commission, which oversees South Washington Park. Ms. Baines Lake, nice to see you.
Good morning. Nice to see you as
Thank you for being here. And Tony Baltimore is president of the Housing Commission's board. Tony, good to see you.
Good morning.
Let's clear up what happened last Tuesday. Residents, I take it, organized a meeting, and some members of the public were asked to leave. Tony, you went so far as to offer an apology here for what happened on Tuesday night. What went wrong?
Well, I don't think anything really necessarily went wrong. It's just a matter of communication. There's also, you know, there's parties that are interested from the city council and the mayor's office and HUD officials to address the concerns at South Washington Park. Our executive director, Patricia Baines Lake, organized really the meeting with residents to hear their concerns first and foremost. That is our top priority, is to hear their concerns and address those concerns appropriately. There was just some miscommunication as to what this meeting was going to be. Was it a board meeting of the board of the Lansing Housing Commission? Was it a city council public safety meeting? That information just did not get out correctly and accurately. This was a resident meeting for residents, but we did invite the city council to attend that meeting along with the mayor's office and two HUD officials were there.
One of the people who was asked to leave, Kathy Miles of the organization Rejuvenating South Lansing, commented to the Lansing State Journal that she believes your organization, the Greater Lansing Housing Commission, along with Mayor Bernero, and I'll quote here, conspired to make non-residents feel intimidated, unquote. Any truth to that?
Absolutely not. There was no conspiracy. In fact, when the meeting was originally planned, it was at a meeting in the mayor's office. And during that meeting, one of the last things that the HUD official said that he was interested in seeing was the opportunity to move forward and that we would have a meeting with residents. So in addition to that, I also communicated to City Council that the meeting last Tuesday was specifically for residents and not for the public. It wasn't to discuss just safety and security. We're looking at transforming the building, and part of that transformation requires a number of communications with residents. And this was just one in a series of communications with residents that was going to occur and did occur that evening with the HUD officials present.
The City Council, in particular the City Council's Public Safety Committee, chaired by Carol Wood, has been involved in this. How do you feel, Tony, about the City Council's efforts and involvement in this so far?
Well, I think it takes a partnership, and I really applaud the city council and being concerned with it, because as a whole, they have constituencies that live obviously in our facility, and so I think it's important for the city council to look at that. We definitely don't want to have the separation here of not talking to one another and trying to make our city and our neighborhood safer. And I think we have to realize that this is a 45-year-old complex with 188 units. This is a neighborhood. It happens to be a high-rise neighborhood, but it is indeed a neighborhood. And so, you know, we've had some bad apples come out of there or happen there. And so we're addressing those issues. I mean, this is an ongoing effort.
But there is tension with the council, though, correct? I mean,
I'd like to think not.
No? Patricia Baines,
I mean, there's some
think?
Disagreements, I think, on how we get there. But
is the city council... Have their efforts been constructive, or are they hampering progress?
I don't think that their efforts thus far have been directed at anything other than gaining information. So in terms of gaining information, I think that they've been open to hearing from residents in terms of moving forward and addressing the issues that exist at South Washington. The Lansing Housing Commission has been more than active in addressing those issues. And we address issues that are brought up by residents, whether it's one resident or 10, whether it's South Washington or one of our other properties. We're not any different than any other landlord when it comes to serving our customers, because they are customers.
Patricia Baines Lake is the executive director of the Lansing Housing Commission. Tony Baltimore is our other guest here on Current State. Tony's president of the Housing Commission's board. We're talking about the challenges at South Washington Park Apartments, 3200 South Washington in Lansing, which is a HUD property. Tony, you've told me that if you could change one thing involving South Washington Park, it would be the tone used by community leaders. How does the tone among community leaders need to change?
Well, I just think we just need to be on the same page. You know, I think last Tuesday's meeting was a classic example of information. You know, I mean, we've had some people, you know, we had Councilmember Wood to leave. You know, that's unfortunate that she was not able to stay, even though those guests were asked to leave.
And again, why were they asked to leave?
Well, because there was some...
the residents organized the meeting, and they wanted it to be a residents-only meeting?
Yes, the residents wanted to address their concerns to those... At the executive director, and of course the mayor, and then the city council members who were there, and the two HUD officials. They have some real concerns as to where we're going forward with the housing commission. You know, we talked about the RAD deal. We talked about the Fatherhood Initiative.
What is that? What is RAD?
It's the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program, which we're going to try. We're looking at how to redevelop that site. Either that site or find another site. And so we're doing that in conjunction with HUD. It's just another program that we're going to apply for those funds to redevelop South Washington.
Patricia Baines Lake, how do you feel about the mayor's role here? Is he playing as big a role as the city council or what?
Well, let me just describe what the Housing Commission is. We already know that it's HUD funded. So the way it operates is it has a board of directors that is appointed by the mayor. The mayor does not have hands-on operation of the Lansing Housing Commission. The employees of the Lansing Housing Commission are not city employees. They are employees of the Lansing Housing Commission. So the reality is both the mayor and the council, we would look to support the efforts to redevelop the property. Redeveloping the property includes looking at a continuing pilot. It involves other property in the city
payment
or throughout
in lieu
the city.
Of taxes?
Payment in lieu of taxes is the pilot. That is correct. So what we need most of all from our elected officials is support in the effort to redevelop the property, minimizing the cost for reconstruction, because the reality is there are 188 units that go vertical right now. Most of the people who live there have expressed a desire for housing development that is more like Oliver Gardens, which sits right behind South Washington. Those are individual townhouse units. We can't put 188 townhouse units on that location. So it's clear as we look to redevelop, we will need additional property in order to redevelop. It is also clear that the dollars and cents don't work without an ongoing payment in lieu of taxes structure. So those are the kinds of support that we need right now from our elected officials. We get great support from the police department. So as far as any issues that have to do with criminal activity, like every other landlord, we get great support. And by the way, this is not the only multifamily development that has experienced a shooting in the last year. It is unfortunate. It is an issue that happens in other neighborhoods in the city of Lansing. It's not anything we'd like to see happen again in our building, and we are concerned about making sure that the building is as safe as humanly possible.
Reading the minutes of some city council meetings, I'm getting the impression that clearly some residents there don't feel safe. Other residents, though, appear to be resisting. I looked at minutes last night that said that Councilman Adam Hussein walked through the building a few months back to find out for himself, to see what the conditions there were like, and he was threatened by someone in the building. So here's a guy trying to help who ends up being threatened when he visits the building. My question is this. Are the residents of South Washington Park of one mind here in terms of moving forward? I mean, some people apparently don't feel they're being heard. Others appear that they may be resisting help. Can you help us understand how the residents of South Washington Park feel?
I think that the majority of the residents do feel like they're being helped. And Pat and her team are there daily. So they really talk to the folks who live there. I think just like any neighborhood or any complex, you're going to get some resistance. I can't speak to the threats to Mr. Hussein, but what I do know is that you have some people who don't live there, and I think there's a lot of you get some visitors in the building who are part of this problem.
Non-residents.
Yeah. Excuse me. So I think that's really a part of the issue. But I think that people sometimes just don't know how to ask for help. I mean, we have monthly board meetings, monthly public board meetings that are posted for our residents that they can come and they can talk about anything. And I wish and I hope that those residents will feel comfortable and not intimidated or not feel like they're being threatened, that they can come and express those concerns and we will address them.
Are there some number of residents at South Washington Park that just need to be evicted? I know you evict people. I mean, that happens.
Absolutely. 95%, approximately 95% of our residents are lease compliant, wonderful residents. And then you have that 5, 10, 15%, whatever the number is, that are not interested in complying with the lease. So on a routine basis, we do evict residents that are not lease compliant. New residents move in. This is a building that is comprised primarily of one-bedroom units. So what you see are a lot of households who are moving away from their parents' home or some other arrangement for the first time living independently. And they don't necessarily come with all the skills that are necessary to be your best neighbor. Mm. Now, we work with them to improve those skills, but there's some that don't intend to improve those skills. And on a regular basis, yes, we do evict residents that are non-lease compliant.
You mentioned, Tony, non-residents and, visitors to the building and in and out, and security, access to the building is an ongoing issue, as I understand it. Is the security at South Washington Park getting tighter, or is it about to get tighter, or what?
Well, our security is ongoing. Again, this is a 45-year-old structure that did not have the 21st century security technology that we have today. So, we've got to catch up. And so we've put some security measures in place. We've worked with the Lansing Police Department and the State Police to come up with ways for a better security system. We tried hands-on security with security personnel, and of course we're limited by funds and what we can spend and what we can do. So we as a board, and really Patricia Baines-Lake as an executive director, we have to find money to support the programs that we have to do in terms of upgrades and security upgrades, facility upgrades, if you will. And so that's really the ongoing challenge.
So there are 9 entrances and exits that anyone can come into if that entrance is left ajar or if someone's going out and someone else slips in behind it. If you are building a structure today, you would never have 9 entrances and exits. And once you enter the hallway, you've actually entered individual's front door, much different than in your own front door on your home or your townhouse. You may have people coming inside of your front door that you would never let in if it was your own home or if it was your own single front door versus 9 entrances.
Right. Tony, the State Journal wrote that on Wednesday, you apologized for the confusion, and you said that you intend to create an open forum for everyone, residents and non-residents, to air their thoughts and ask questions. Have you made any progress on that? What do you have in mind?
Well, the executive director and I, we've talked about it, and we're going to talk about it as a board in our next board meeting. But again, these conversations are ongoing. We want to provide as much information as we can to the not only to the public, but really to our residents. And so we're going to continue to work with those who are interested, with neighborhood groups, city council, the mayor's office, and again HUD, to develop ways and to put together really communications that lets people understand and know that, you know, we're going to take this serious. And I think that those meetings are going to happen over the next 6 months.
Tony Baltimore is president of the Lansing Housing Commission Board. We also want to thank Patricia Baines Lake, executive director of the Lansing Housing Commission. We've been discussing the challenges facing South Washington Park Apartments in Lansing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, we all love taking selfies, but how about a financial selfie? Current State's Brooke Allen talks to a financial professional who says organizing your finances is really a 4-step progress, a process. That's coming up on Current State. Well, listeners of a certain age will remember that before television, radio was one of the most popular forms of entertainment here in America, but that doesn't have to be a thing of the past, thanks to Lansing's Audio Air Force. It performs classic radio pieces for a live audience, and they're putting on a free performance this Friday evening at the Mica Gallery in Old Town Lansing. Joining us to tell us more and give us a little preview, Dave Downing, founder of the Audio Air Force. Good to see you, Dave.
Morning, Mark.
And Katrina Daniels is program director of the Mica Gallery in Old Town. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well.
Dave, you're a radio guy from way back. I can't even remember the first time we crossed paths. It was
I'll never tell. That'll be our secret.
Our dirty little secret. You've been in the business a long time. When and how did you get this idea to start the Audio Air Force?
Well, I've been doing audio theater for probably 30-some years when I was working at LCC in teaching broadcasting and working with the audio and performing arts department there, and then got involved with the National Audio Theater Festivals that do workshops around the country. Did that for several years, and then when I retired from LCC, I just really missed doing audio theater, so decided, well, why not? Let's see if it'll work here.
How does a performance work here for someone who's never been to one? I'm sitting here imagining, I'm kind of flashing on a Prairie Home Companion
exactly.
with Garrison Keillor and the sound effects and the weird voices and everything.
It's the same concept. He's improved on the old-time radio way of doing things quite a bit. But it's a general concept. You have the actors doing the lines, and you have live music on one side of the stage, and you'll have a crew where we don't have somebody as talented as Garrison Keillor has to do sound effects verbally. We have a crew that does...
Fred Newman, right?
Newman does sound effects by using objects.
And we're gonna sample here some of the Audio Air Force's sounds that they create. And Dave, you're gonna share help us with that. How is this performance suited? Is the Mica Gallery well suited to a performance of the Audio Air Force?
Oh, absolutely!
Katrina,
yeah,
it seemed like a lot of fun.
Oh, it is. So our mission is actually to use quality arts programming for community development. And last year, I was lucky enough to go to the Pump House in East Lansing, and I saw War of the Worlds with Audio Air Force, and I just loved it, and I thought it was fantastic. And we do a lot of performance art and theater at Mica Gallery, but afterwards, I found Dave and said, listen, I think this is fantastic. I haven't seen this. Can we bring this to Mica? And so, yeah, we're making it a reality.
Here we are, Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a clip from a couple of past performances. The first one here is from Casablanca. Let's hear it.
That's what she said, Stan. Nobody can play as time goes by like you.
Aren't you going to stop drinking and go to bed, boss?
Of all the gin joints and all the towns and all the world, she walks into mine. No, play as time goes by, Sam.
Oh, I don't think I can remember it, boss.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it. I got a date with a memory.
Oh, a classic line from a classic film. Let's hear another one here. This is from a performance here called Homefront, and it's a scene where someone's being rescued from a fire. It's a good example of your use of sound effects.
Oh, thank God you found her. And now, careful now. Lift her gently. That's it. Okay, boys, get into Memorial Hospital fast.
Let's go.
Hey, where'd that guy go?
So what did you do there to create the sound of the fire, Dave?
We had, believe it or not, we had cellophane and newspaper
okay.
that were crumbled up in the background, and
yeah.
we had three people doing that. We had somebody who actually had a small car door that was used to slam, and then, of course, we had the car that was recorded.
The siren?
And the siren was recorded
okay.
as well.
Okay, that was recorded.
Those were drop-ins.
Well. Dave Downing is our guest, the founder of the Audio Air Force, also Katrina Daniels, program director of Mica Gallery in Old Town, where the Audio Air Force is performing Arsenic and Old Lace here Friday evening. What did you enjoy most about the experience when you saw the Orson Welles show?
You know, I think that we're so inundated by visuals. When you go to see film, we're so inundated by just explosions and these big CGI kind of action elements all the time. And with Dave's performance with Audio Air Force, you really sit back and your imagination takes over.
Yeah.
And I also found the sound effects just to be, they're so innovative, and it was really, really charming. And it was something I had never experienced before. And maybe other generations have sort of grown up with it, but I thought it was just fantastic.
The theater of the mind.
Yeah,
right?
It's something that we as a culture have become a lot more visually oriented. When you go to movies, it's a lot of computer generated graphics, which is great. But you have, lost the imagination, the theater of the mind, as you mentioned. When we do demonstrations, we do things like we'll have a door that closes, and then we ask people, what did you just hear? Well, everybody heard a door closing, but some people hear a big door, some people hear a kitchen door, some people have a door to a bedroom, some people hear a door going outside.
Mm.
So everybody hears the same thing, but everybody's experience is slightly different.
Yeah, the other appealing thing about this, and I've noticed this on the increase in recent decades, is that people have become more and more accustomed to seeing what is going on behind the scenes. And there's mm-hmm. a real appeal for that. There's always been appeal for that for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a period in television where all you would see is what the camera showed you. But then there was a period where, I don't know if it was Saturday Night Live, I think it was actually before that, where the camera would show the cameras shooting, you're seeing more and more of what's going on behind the scenes. And I think there's mm-hmm. just an attraction to that whole thing. Dave, you've brought some materials with you that are used to make some of these sound effects. You're going to give us a demonstration. Tell us the sound effect and then make the sound. Maybe our listeners can try to guess what materials you're using. You got
okay,
a few let me examples
just do
here.
Do the sound and have you figure out what noise it is.
Okay.
Okay, here we go.
Okay. I hear a duck quacking.
That's exactly what
that
I was thinking.
That could be a duck, but it's a chicken.
Okay, a chicken clucking.
It's a lot easier to get a chicken to cluck on cue this way than it is to have a chicken in the studio.
Okay, go.
This is just a solo cup with a string through the middle of it, and I have a slightly damp sponge, and wrap the sponge around the string, and then just kind of pinch it and pull.
I mean, I wish you could see this, because I would never have... I mean, how in the world? Somebody actually figured that out.
It's amazing.
It's a red solo drink cup with a string stuck in the bottom of it, and Dave is kind of yanking on the string with a wet sponge, and it's creating that clucking sound. Lay another one.
This is another one. Maybe we can get you to help on this one, Mark.
Oh, okay. Whoops.
We'll do that one. Okay, now what I want you to do is to take this and shake it up. And then just hold it right by the microphone. Ready?
Just shake,
shake
it,
up real it
and
then
hold it by
it
the
steady.
Microphone. Okay.
Sound like thunder?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
These are just BBs inside of a party balloon.
So a couple of blown up balloons with BBs inside it. We shook them, and then as that kind of...
Really sounds like a storm is rolling in.
Yeah, yeah, really well done. And we've got one more.
Yeah, one more. This is, we were talking about War of the Worlds. We had War of the Worlds. It would have been so easy just to create an audio effect for the flying saucers, but we thought it would be more fun and more visual to do for the audience if we had somebody do the sound of the...
And describe how you're creating that. Long plastic tubes.
Yeah, it's a long plastic tube that has ridges in it, and it's a kid's toy, and you just twirl it around and makes that noise.
Well, Dave Downing, founder of the Audio Air Force, we're up against the clock, I'm sorry to say, but we did have the great demonstrations here. Dave Downing of the Audio Air Force and Mica Gallery's program director, Katrina Daniels. It's Arsenic and Old Lace by the Audio Air Force, Friday evening at 7 o'clock at Mica. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Current State, WKAR's Peter Worf speaks with Dr. Charles Hyde, former Wayne State University professor and author of the 2014 book Images from the Arsenal of Democracy. That and more after the break on Current State. We are always interested in your feedback here for Current State. You can email us at currentstate@wkar.org. You can even call me directly, Mark Bayshore, 517-884-4776. Always interested in your feedback and constructive criticism. Most people enjoy taking pictures. Of course, selfies are all the rage, but what about a financial selfie? Current State's Brooke Allen joins us. Brooke, what is a financial selfie?
Well, Mark, a financial selfie is the equivalent of snapping a picture of your finances. So you have a better idea of where you stand with your savings account, your debt, even perhaps your lunch money. So I asked Scott Cardi of Cardi Capital, where do you start?
The first step is creating a solid financial plan, making sure you understand where you're at. So in order to do this, you really want to kind of gather all of your financial information together. Look at debt, student loans, car loans, credit card payments. Make a list and keep track of your balances, interest rates, payment due dates to make sure that you're not racking up any unnecessary fees. Then look at other expenses, utility payments, cell phone bills, groceries, and entertainment. Then compare that against how much you make. Okay, so really what you want to try to do is almost that the word that everybody hates is a budget. Okay, take a look at what expenses you have coming in, and then what income you have coming in. If your expenses outweigh your income, you're going to have to take a hard look at where you can cut. You know, with my clients, what we do is we try to build really kind of like a roadmap, okay? A way for them to see where they're at today, where they want to go, and really the most efficient way to get there. And part of doing that is to look at this financial selfie, look at this budget, and see where you're at right now. But I think you also want to have a goal. So you want to set a goal to know where you're going, all right? So I would suggest you, before the end of this week, try to create a goal so that you can know next year whether you're on track. Okay, with all of my clients, we have a target every year that we want to hit. And that way next year, myself and my clients both know whether we need to make some adjustments or whether we're on the right path. Just like if you were traveling, okay? If you were traveling, you would want to have a starting spot. So let's say Detroit right now is our starting point, and we want to head over to San Diego. So most of us wouldn't just hop in the car and head west. You know, although I think I'm smart enough that I can just head west and hit traffic and construction and mountains and valleys, you know, and eventually make my way to California and head down to San Diego. But there's more efficient ways to do things, to do your finances than that, to travel than that. You know, nowadays, you could use a GPS, a roadmap, in order to get you the most efficient way. And that's really what we're talking about here, is having a starting point, but also having a destination. Where do you want to be? And what's the most efficient way to get you from where you are today to where you want to be in the future?
You know, people really do dread, like you mentioned, the word budget, number one. And then also, I think it's hard to sit down and actually say, okay, you know what, whether it be by yourself, if you're not married, or, you know, if you still live with your parents or whatever the situation may be, and say, you know, I need to do this. I need to know where I stand with all your papers and say, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be disciplined and I'm going to do it and I'm going to get it right.
Yeah, I think it is a difficult situation, and that's why we try to set 1 week out of every year just to really get a firm grasp on your finances. So if you take your credit card statements, if you take your bank statements, and you look through that and see where are you spending money. Now, you're the one creating this budget, so you can put whatever you want down, but what you're trying to understand is how much money is going out. Where are you spending money? Are you spending too much in certain places that need to be adjusted, or are you fine with your spending? So you're really the one that creates your budget. You're just trying to get a grasp of, are you spending money properly?
Okay, so let me ask you this. When you say do this for a week, are you talking about start on a Sunday and go through the following Sunday and keep all your receipts and just, like, I mean, when you fill the car up with gas, everything you do as far as that goes, is that what you're talking about?
Not necessarily. I think I would just use your last month's statement and get an idea from last month. But there are things that you're going to have to add in there, like birthday presents, Christmas, you know, areas where you spend a little bit more money seasonally than you normally would. But I think if you just put the label on it, okay, this week I'm going to get my budget together, it's not so overwhelming. Instead of always having it in the back of your mind, okay, I should be working at my budget and I should be trying to figure it out. Just kind of set aside 1 week to get things straightened out for the year. So it doesn't necessarily have to be collect my receipts all this week. It really needs, you know, you could probably do this in an hour. Just if you stayed focused, set all of your statements in front of you, and just tried to get a grasp on where you're at. But I think just by labeling it, okay, this week is when we're going to get our financial selfie in order, then it's less daunting than if you throughout the year aren't really doing it, but always have it in the back of your mind that you should be.
Right, of course. And then, of course, there's always that looming tax season and everyone's trying to get their tax receipts. But
yeah,
we'll save that for another conversation, of course.
Another episode, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to, I know that a lot of people go out to lunch. A lot of people maybe skip lunch and maybe go out for coffee or pick up a coffee on the way into work or the way out of work. And, you know, I do know, and I freely admit that could possibly add up. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think there's easy ways to try to save some money if you find out from your financial selfie that you are needing to cut back a little bit. And one of those ways is to bring your lunch. All right, it's really easy to go out to lunch, but the money that you save by bringing a lunch from home can really add up.
Give me an example of how much you think that saves.
Yeah, if you pack your lunch 5 times a week and invest your savings, you could save more than $2,300 a year, which is about $23,000 in 10 years. So there are some ways that money could add up. You know, $23,000 is a lot of money. To be able to not spend that on lunch and to be able to save it toward your investments or toward your future, that's huge.
Define meet your match, and I don't think you're talking about a dating website. What are you talking about?
No, that's not one of the services we provide here. But so meet your match. Ideally, you want to be putting away somewhere between 10 and 15% of your income to save for retirement. And I understand that may not be feasible for everybody to do that. You know, if all of us are in different seasons of our life. You know, whether you're paying off student loans or you have a new home or kids in college, you know, but the idea is to try to work your way up to that 10 to 15% of your income towards retirement. So for a lot of us, we have employers that will match, and typically that matches somewhere around 3%. So if you can do nothing else, take advantage of your employer's match. You may have to call your HR person and just ask them, hey, what is the match that we get, and how do I make sure that I'm taking advantage of that? So for some companies, they also offer a Roth option. And without getting too technical, you really want to kind of look into that Roth option, because this is after-tax money that you put in that grows tax-free. So this really will help you out in your future. As far as when you start to pull the money out, you get tax-free money instead of into a traditional 401k or a traditional IRA, where that's money that you all pay tax on. But the big part in this section, in the meet your match, is really looking to see what your employer is going to give you for free and take advantage of that free money. We all like free money.
I am talking to financial professional Scott Carty with Carty Capital, who is telling us ways to get our money on the right track. And of course, Scott, before we wrap up, the big thing and the most important thing of everything would be to just set a goal.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Because if you don't have a target, a destination, then you really could end up anywhere. So, you know, I have a lot of people that come into my office and sit down, and they aren't looking to retire for 10 years, and they're just looking for help today, and then they don't think they need help throughout the year or throughout the next couple of years. They just really want to come back in 10 years and say, okay, well, now what? And that's really kind of a bad way to do it, because you really want to make sure year by year that you're on track towards your goals. So it's important to write down a goal of where you want to be at next year. That way you can see, you know, whether this is a good year or a bad year, you're going to be able to see next year whether you're on track and whether adjustments are needed to make sure that you stay on track. Whether your goal is to retire in 10 years, 20, 30, or maybe your goal is just to make sure that your financial selfie looks better next year, that your expenses don't outweigh your income. But you want to have some sort of goal to make sure that you're on track, and write it down. Keep it in front of you. Put it in a place that you're going to see it, whether it's on your bathroom mirror or at your desk. Make sure that you see that goal throughout the year, because this will increase your motivation and your likelihood that you'll reach your goal.
Okay, so really your bottom line and your biggest advice is to write it down.
It is. You will accomplish so much more by writing down that goal and putting it in a place that you can see. Whether it's just once a week or hopefully every day that you see that goal, that will increase your motivation and increase the chances that you're going to hit that goal.
Well, thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And I guess we'll see how this goes and see how much people can get their financial selfie in order.
Absolutely, Brooke. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, thanks so much. To see how much you can improve your financial selfie by packing your lunch, we'll have a link at WKAR.org. Yummy? Maybe not, but at least you'll have some extra cash, and then you'll be smiling pretty. For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. 75 years ago, the U.S. was tooling up to enter the cauldron of World War. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt termed our nation's weapons and war goods buildup an arsenal of democracy. Images from the Arsenal of Democracy is the 2014 book by former Wayne State University professor Dr. Charles Hyde. The book follows the wartime transformation of the Detroit auto industry into the war machine of the early 1940s. WKAR's Peter Worf speaks with Dr. Hyde by phone. Hyde began the conversation by talking about Willow Run's legendary planes and their power plants.
If there was one thing the auto companies were set up to do, although these engines were different from what they were used to, was to make engines in large quantities. You know, they had no experience with making aircraft wings or tails or fuselage sections or anything like that. They kind of had to learn that on the fly, but they at least had some knowledge about engines, so they were a natural choice. The other reason the auto industry became so important, and this really was by design from Bill Knutson and others, is that they had experience in mass-producing complicated products using interchangeable parts. And if you were going to ramp up aircraft production, you had to get away from this sort of handicraft system that the aircraft companies used to mass production techniques. And the auto industry, because of all their experiences, you know, starting with Henry Ford and the Model T, they were well set up to, design and produce blueprints and then produce the machinery needed to mass produce these materials. And, you know, it's amazing. At its height, the Willow Run plant, which made B-24 Liberator bombers out in Ypsilanti, they were producing a bomber an hour.
Yeah.
On an assembly line. It was like cars, except planes are bigger and more complicated.
And this was Willow Run's product, a giant flying machine for which the plant was so carefully tooled that it could produce one every 55 minutes. This is the Army Air Force's Liberator heavy bomber.
Yeah, it's interesting that you point out before the war, planes were more of a handmade, handcrafted item. And the transformation comes when you have to churn out thousands of them in a week's time.
Well, and when you've got parts coming from as many as 10 or 15 suppliers, at that point, the blueprints have to work. They have to be accurate, and they have to be consistent. Otherwise, you end up with a bunch of parts that don't fit.
Dr. Hyde, speaking of blueprints, I thought an image that made quite an impression on me from the 2014 images from the Arsenal of Democracy was one of many, many men in a huge room working on blueprints, almost as far as you can see, guys sort of moving around the room, guys up on top of tables working on these blueprints.
Yeah, that was the practice called lofting, which actually came from the shipbuilding industry. When ships were designed, they actually would build full-size blueprints showing all the different curves and parts of the ship. And this practice transferred over to the aircraft industry. And in fact, those bombers were referred to as ships, not as airplanes, because a lot of the design methods were the same. And what you see in that one image was very large sections of the fuselage at full size on those big tables.
Here's a story that you told about something that you learned about extensive testing at the Dodge Chicago plant, where engines were built at this 3.5 million square foot facility. And there is impressive story about building and taking apart engines. Can you recall that?
Yes. Aircraft engines were subject to a testing protocol or methodology that was really unlike anything you saw in the automobile industry. You know, the automobile industry did design engines and then would run tests on those engines, but they would typically test a few of them in the early stages and of the design process to make sure they were acting like they were supposed to. But once they went into production of, say, a V8 engine, they might pull one out of every 100 off the assembly line to run some tests to make sure it was still up to standard. But when we get to aircraft engines, they extensively tested every single engine, normally for 4 hours on a test stand at these factories. But the remarkable thing is they would then let the engine cool off and take it apart into all of its thousands of pieces. And they would lay those pieces out on benches. And first of all, they would visually examine every single piece for things like cracks or wear or, you know, other defects, signs of stress. A lot of the parts were then also x-rayed to make sure there was no stress or damage to the parts. And when there were parts that were defective, they would replace them with new ones and then run the engine for another 4 hours before finally shipping it out to go into an airplane. The interesting thing about that process, as I discovered in looking at some of the detailed records of some of the plants, is that more than half of the inspectors were women who inspected these parts that, you know, these disassembled aircraft engines. It's a very interesting phenomenon that really surprised me. I had no idea. A lot of these aircraft plants, almost all the women that were employed were inspectors. That's what they did.
Dr. Charles Hyde is the author of Images from the Arsenal of Democracy. That's a 2014 publication by Wayne State University Press, also the author of Arsenal of Democracy, the American Automobile Industry in World War II, also from Wayne State University Press, and the author of many other books. He was a professor at Wayne State University. So then, after the war, what was that transition like for automakers going from war production back to automobile production?
It was difficult, to say the least. The government began flat-out canceling a lot of their war contracts by February or March of 1945, even though the war was still going on. They knew the end of the war in Europe was pretty inevitable. They didn't know quite how quickly it would happen. And that meant that those workers, at least temporarily, were thrown out of work. And there was, during the rest of 1945, quite a bit of unemployment as the auto industry tried to convert back to civilian automobile production. It really wasn't until late 1946 and into 1947 that the auto industry really got back to close to full production of automobiles. It was a very difficult transition.
Dr. Charles Hyde is the author of the 2014 book Images from the Arsenal of Democracy. That's from Wayne State University Press, a companion book to Arsenal of Democracy, the American Automobile Industry in World War II, also from Wayne State University Press. Dr. Hyde, thanks very much.
Okay, you're very welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Ward.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, we review July's environmental news with Great Lakes journalist Gary Wilson. We'll learn more about Michigan's incoming director of the Department of Environmental Quality. Heidi Grather is a former oil company lobbyist who takes charge at DEQ next week. The group Common Cause Michigan wants state officials to share all communications involving Ms. Grather's appointment. We'll also learn about Enbridge Oil's PR campaign promoting the Kalamazoo River cleanup. Later this week, the Washtenaw Community Concert Band goes to Tinseltown for their next performance. We'll speak with Dr. Chris Heindreich about those Hollywood blockbusters and learn about some of the costume changes he's had to make in Ann Arbor. That is on the way. Again, live first-person storytelling this Thursday evening in East Lansing at its Current State's pop-up stories about the outdoors. We're calling it The Call of the Wild. 7 p.m., Valley Court Park, East Lansing. More information on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Bring your own chairs if you're staying for the movie. This is before the movie that they show at Valley Court Park here throughout the summer months, so we're dovetailing with that event. Bring your own chairs if you plan to stick around for the movie, as per usual. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. Everything we do on this program ends up on the podcast. All of our segments, science and tech, music, theater, environmental news, healthcare, education, politics, you name it. Stories from all around Michigan and your hometown. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. On Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. We'll see you Tuesday on Current State.